Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for another conversation. Today we have a more or less familiar figure to join us. It's the guy next door in the office, Rusty Reno.
Hey there, Mark.
Editor-in-chief of First Things. And we're going to...
You can call me sir.
Yes, Herr Professor, certainly. But today we're not going to talk about current events. We're not going to talk about politics, at least at the current moment. We are going to spend a little time asking Editor Reno about books. In particular, a question that I often like to ask people, which I often take as a measure of someone's intellectual condition or values, whatever, and that is, what are the books that were important to you in those formative years, late adolescence, in your 20s? When you're sort of coming out of that adolescence and into adulthood. And so we're just going to spend...
Mark, are you convinced that I've made it to adulthood?
Well, we're both almost 60. So Judge Judy says that men don't quite grow up, if ever, before age 50. So we're past that border. Anyway, first question. You went to college at...
Haverford College.
Haverford College.
I'm a fighting nerd from Haverford.
and that was, I can't remember, you wrote about your experiences working out west on the pipelines.
Right.
Was that before college?
No, I didn't go to college right away. I applied, but then deferred, and I lived in Yosemite Valley for the better part of the year as a climbing bum. And I remember I had my backpack with my climbing gear, but I also had, two books, really more accurately three. One was the two-volume Richard Feynman's Lectures on Physics, which I never opened. And the other, why I had it in my backpack, I don't know, but I vividly remember having it. My sister was a physics major. She's a couple years older than me, who I idolized, my older sister. I still idolize my older sister. And so I think I was kind of somehow trying to be like my great sister. And I also had Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain.
Okay.
Which I read that fall of 1978 in Yosemite Valley. And help me here, Mark, it's Settembrini, the Italian humanist, versus Naphtha, the Jew turned Jesuit, contesting for the soul of Hans Kostrup, the bourgeois German who's gone to visit a friend at the sanatorium in the Swiss mountains, but who winds up kind of convincing himself that he too has tuberculosis and winds up staying. And that's kind of an image of escape. And I remember reading that in Yosemite and Hans Kostrup kind of running away from the world in this enclosed, set apart environment. And I thought to myself, that's kind of what I'm doing as a climbing bum, and that
fits.
I need to get back to reality. And so when I went back to college, it was a good cautionary book. It was a book that helped me understand the futility of trying to pursue the meaning of life in some kind of set apart recreation, or imagining that you can be set yourself apart from the ordinary run of people, or the kind of traumas or challenges that we face as a society.
I mean, one thing, just virtue of the fact of going from, you were in Baltimore, grew up in Baltimore, out to the American West, big change.
I'd been out a number of times.
You had.
With my family, and did a Sierra Club service trip one summer at age 16 and kind of on my own, flew out to Los Angeles. And so I was already in love with the American West and just the vastness. Another book I read.
I'll just say one thing. Feynman is still idolized by physicists.
Well.
And mathematicians and engineers, anyone who...
And justly so. And when I was there, one of my classmates, Webb Ewell, who I in my high school went to Caltech, wound up going to Caltech, And it just so happened that my best buddy that I, friends I made in Yosemite lived in Pasadena where Caltech is. And so I visited Webb, and it happened to be the day that Feynman every Wednesday afternoon or something had at 4 o'clock would go to a classroom. It was an open session and students could ask him any question.
Wow.
And so I sat in there while students asked him questions about how stereo equipment work. I mean, I can't remember. I remember there was something there about speakers and sound waves or something like that. But he, so I actually saw the great man in action.
Wow. That helps explain why he was revered. He'd take the time.
Take the time.
To talk to 19-year-olds and say, no rules.
No rules. And not just that, but what was impressive is that although he was a theoretical physicist of the absolute first rank, he had a kind of hands-on knowledge about technical engineering type things. And I think it's, you know, we've done these articles in the mag with John Waters on work, and then we had the piece on manual manhood.
Chris Wiley.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that it could be that, you know, Feynman, that there's your speculative imagination is enriched by a kind of practical know-how.
This is what I kept telling myself as my son was asking for another Lego. So,
but when I was in, it could, might have been while I was in Yosemite, I also read Desert Solitaire by, help me here, Mark. Come on. Who wrote Desert Solitaire?
Who wrote? I know.
It's on the tip of my tongue. A great kind of curmudgeonly figure in the American West, and it's about his year as a park ranger in Arches National Monument in the wintertime. And this is back before people actually came to national parks in the millions. And that was also a kind of, if you will, spirituality of the wilderness. Edward Abbey, that's who wrote Desert Solitaire.
Okay.
And I and it was at that age, 19, that I was reading Carl Jung, Freud, Civilization's Discontents, Moses and Monotheism, Paul Tillich, the Dynamics
of Faith.
The
big picture psychology.
Well, it was not just that, but it was I was attracted to all these books that were about religion, but it was in that kind of spiritual but not religious vein. And Paul Tillich's The Dynamics of Faith. And, you know, Jung is very appealing to people who have any kind of religious instinct because he argues against the sufficiency of the scientific mode of understanding. Of course,
a fervent believer in God.
But he puts in its place a kind of ersatz mythology, which is a kind of pseudoscientific. He thinks that there are these deep archetypes, the collective unconscious, all that kind of stuff. So it really wasn't until I got to college that I was exposed to real theology. And I just happened to have at my little college a teacher, Ronald Thiemann, who was a real theologian, Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, trained at Concordia Theological Seminary, did his PhD at Yale in this neo-Orthodox post-liberal tradition. And so he put us through the paces, and I read Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Karl Barth, Kierkegaard, you know, these classics of modern Christian thought. And that's what really influenced me the most.
That sounds like a very good course of study. You don't go to college first. You take that year off, the gap year. You go out to Yosemite, you climb rocks, and you read Thomas Mann, you have your physics there. But also, there was a cosmic curiosity, it sounds like, that may not have been disciplined in a way, but there must have been something that would draw you. I mean, how many of the climbers that you met had Thomas Mann in their backpacks? How many of them wanted to go to Caltech and catch a few minutes of Feynman?
Oh, it's a mixed crew.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
What did I was there in the winter, and you run out of things to read. And John Yablonsky, sadly, not the happiest person in the world, and sadly committed suicide, I think, when he was 40. But John, or Yabo, as we called him, had a storage locker with all of his stuff in it. I think he had been kicked out of his family's home. And in it was Conan the Barbarian. I can vividly remember reading
The Conan series,
yes. Courtesy of Yabo, along with Frank Herbert's Dune. That was another. So that was the sci-fi. I think that's probably the more typical. Don't you think that's the late adolescent male genre?
That was. I had friends in the 70s when I was a teenager who were into the Frank Herbert.
Yeah, because it's kind of highbrow stuff. Sci-fi.
Yeah. I mean, look. One book that I actually really loved when I was 15 years old was Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles.
Yes.
Those are great. I still think those are great, great stories. And they stick. We were talking before we started about how a lot of the books that have that formative power, they do stay with you. You remember glimpses of them. For me, more so than a lot of the books that I read last year.
Right.
They seem fresher because...
I guess we lay them down, so to speak, in the brain, where they're not being crowded out by other things.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the books I read, I come back to, and my freshman English class was, it was a thematic kind of comp class, and it was organized around Norman O. Brown's 1959 classic, Life Against Death. And Norman O. Brown's thesis is that culture is based on repression, and it's kind of a Freudian thesis. Culture is based on repression, and in that sense, it is an instrument of death, whereas desire, instinct, is vitality, and it's the source of life. And you know, I dutiful freshman, kind of, you know, read it, got the thesis. I had no idea. It struck me as a kind of puerile view of things. I mean, even at age 18 or 19, I recognized how adolescent Norman O. Brown's way of thinking was.
But boy, you know, like what a craze!
Authority is authority. You know, if you're 18, you know, you're thinking, "Oh, authority. That's what's kind of holding me back." You get to college. Right. Nobody's paying. You know, no one's telling you what to do. Yeah. Life, and I guess maybe because I'd been in Yosemite on my own for a year, going to college wasn't such a great, liberation. And so it struck me. And I've come back to that again and again. That book by Norman O. Brown, because I think he states in a particularly blatant way a very widespread assumption, post 1960s assumption. And he was prophetic. He foresaw the rebellion of the adolescent, the youth rebellion against authority, against repression, against restraint.
He caught the zeitgeist. When I was in college in the 70s, there were still people hanging around who were profoundly, teachers, younger teachers I had who were students in the 60s. That book hit them very hard.
Yes.
And they would still refer to Brown. But even by the 70s, it wasn't, young people weren't reading that. I mean, younger people reading that book by then.
Oh, I agree. You know,
it passed quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the professor who assigned it was an elderly English professor who did not have sympathy for Brown's thesis, but I think was astute enough to recognize that Brown laid out the defining, Brown outlined the structure of the cultural question that's still with us. I mean, this is the culture war. It's the authority of traditional norms versus ever greater freedom for desire to find its own way. And so I'm very grateful
to have read that
book.
You don't hear people talking much in those terms about authority. The way in the 50s and 60s, authority was an issue from a book I think you mentioned recently, The Authoritarian Personality,
right,
which was 1950. But a lot of the slogans, question authority, and so I think maybe they won so sound, the rebellious mind won so soundly that authority is we don't even need to contest it anymore. Although of course authority never goes away.
It never goes away, and that's another book that I didn't read it until I was in graduate school. But Philip Reeve's book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, really helped me understand that.
Well, when did you read that first?
Probably in 1985, maybe, as a grad student. And there, he helped me see that the authority has been transformed. So it's therapeutic authority and not, what we may say, a Aristotelian authority. So for Aristotle, your teacher is, if you will, the master of a certain discipline, or you know, you have the phronimos, the wise man who habituates the young person to be wise, and towards that end, whereas the therapeutic authority is always an empowering authority.
Yeah.
Wants to empower you to be yourself. So that's the sense in which people often say, how can you say that, Norman O'Brien, I mean, he can't possibly be relevant. Look at today's college campuses, political correctness. But what political correctness is a kind of policing to ensure that everyone has the freedom to be themselves.
Right.
So it's an enforced culture of therapeutic affirmation of yourself and then everyone else too.
Right.
So Reeve helped me see that the therapeutic ideal has its own, if you will, it has its own disciplinary logic.
And how do they deal with the inevitable clash of two people who, in respectively being themselves, are pushing against one another?
Well, we know how they resolve. So let's say that I'm a traditional Christian, and let's say that you're someone trying to what's the euphemism here? Explore the boundaries. And you're the dean is having to mediate the conflict. We know how that always turns out.
We do.
The person who has the traditional views is judgmental, and the person who's exploring the boundaries is questioning authority. So it really hasn't changed.
Right,
so
right,
anytime
right.
There's a clash between a traditional worldview and this one that is pursuing personal authenticity or some kind of culture of transgression. The culture of transgression always, always, always wins.
When we make that personal, the therapeutic affirmation a factor, it can't be about tolerance because others must tolerate this, because tolerance implies you don't like it.
No, you're
but
not
you're
right.
Tolerating it. You're accepting it, but you still don't like it. That's not enough. The affirmation has to, it's not just you can affirm yourself, others must affirm you as well. This is where I think in just recent years we've crossed a different line on John Stuart Mill would look at a lot of this and say this is as coercive as
I'm not sure you can exculpate Mill. He thought in On Liberty that the social consensus is the most tyrannical, far more so than laws. And if that's true and you really care about liberty, you have to dismantle the social consensus.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's
yeah.
pretty much what the the postmodern multicultural pedagogy of not just higher ed but secondary and primary education sets out to do.
Has the psychological or psychosocial aspect of this contemporary form of dismantling liberalism, that seems to have dropped out. I mean, the Freudian background for
We've kind of forgotten
for Brown. That's just that has been forgotten. Do you have an explanation for that?
I don't know, but when I was an undergrad, I think I read.
I mean, Reeve's first book was on Freud.
Yes, and Freud was still part of the canon when I was an undergraduate. You had to reckon with Freud, and I think I read all everything that Herbert Marcuse wrote when I was an undergraduate. Because Marcuse is the humanitarian left figure who most was most, I think, accepted the Freudian categories most thoroughly, or incorporated them into his Marxism most thoroughly. Eros and Civilization runs along the same tracks as Norman O'Brown's Life Against Death. And so freedom for Marcuse is primarily, more fundamentally, a cultural freedom as opposed to a political economic freedom. And that cultural freedom was the freedom from you know, bourgeois expectation, say. And so transgression, the kind of pageantry and the 68 environment, the spectacle of transgression was something that attracted Marcuse, and Marcuse championed it, unlike some of his confreres with the Frankfurt School, who were more of kind of high culture folks. I mean, Theodore Adorno was horrified by 1968 because he was a high culture Marxist, whereas right. Marcuse recognized, I think, that transgression, cultural transgression, and going low, as Philip Reeve might say, has a revolutionary quality to it. So I read that. But, you know, by the time I got to grad school, I was studying theology, and the most important books were theological books. I read, I'm trying to think of the books, F.J.A. Hort, The Way, the Truth, and the Life. Hort was one of the early, he was a figure that was a philologist primarily, was instrumental in the critical edition of the New Testament that is the predecessor of the one we use today. But it was a kind of meditation on that passage from the Gospel of John. There was Austin Farrer, St. Matthew and St. Mark, William Temple, Readings in St. John's Gospel. How's that for an exciting title?
Are these still in the syllabus in theology?
Oh, they weren't in the syllabus when I was. These are what books I found in the library. I mean, the most important books that one reads are often the books that are next to the books that you're looking for in the library.
Yeah.
So they're ones that you're not looking for.
Well, Rosie, listen, one of the horrible, awful, catastrophic, calamitous, disastrous advents of the digital age is you don't go up to the library and look for one book and then browse in both directions.
Those are all books I found
browsing.
Browse.
You're just searching sort of openly and you're pulling this off there. One thing that that got me on the anti-digital trend was going up to the library in 2008 and wandering around the stacks and saying to myself, am I in a morgue? There's nobody here. They're all downstairs at the screens. But anyway, let's get back to you.
And not only when you go to the library, because I remember I was on sabbatical in Princeton and I was looking for the memoir of, what's Virginia Woolf's husband's name?
Leonard
Woolf. And next to his memoir was Richard Weaver's kind of collection of his autobiographical writings. And it was in that volume that I read his wonderful essay, Up From Liberalism. And so that was one of the great kind of serendipitous. So it's the serendipity that is really to be cultivated. Used bookstores, for instance, are a great opportunity there. I was on...
Oh, yes.
I was here in New York after college because I was too disorganized to get my application for grad school together in time, so I had to wait a year before starting grad school. And in a used bookstore, it was right there on, Amsterdam Avenue and 121st Street near where I lived, that I came across this copy of Norman Podhoretz's book, Breaking Ranks.
Breaking Ranks.
And it's about his movement left to right. And I was already moving in that direction myself. And Podhoretz describes all of the ways in which his friends, just the horror with which people responded to his increasingly critical disposition towards establishment liberalism.
Even small steps
away
from the party line
would evoke all
the
this
overreaction.
Ire. And I was experiencing that, and it accelerated my own movement. Because I realized
they pushed you.
That reading Podhoretz
unintentionally.
Yeah, reading Podhoretz allowed me to understand what I was experiencing, and it made me all the more aware. Like, wait a minute, this is just groupthink that I'm dealing with, and not really a kind of reasoned effort to respond to my questions.
Right. Well, it's the conformity, the nonconformists. that set in pretty early on. When you moved toward your dissertation, were there some books that mapped it out for you?
No, my dissertation was kind of misbegotten. So I did a degree, a project on Karl Rahner. Although that's not fair. I read a lot of books. It was about individual in community, so it was a kind of collectivist individualist debate, and I read Eric Foglin's New Science of Politics that had a big influence on me. I can't remember a single thing Foglin says, but I remember reading it, and because what Foglin does is he takes a theological vocabulary in order to look at modern politics, ideological politics, as a kind of theological project. And I found that very helpful. And to this day, I think it even if you disagree with every single piece of analysis that Foglin provides, the basic framework is really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The spiritual, theological logic of modern ideologically driven politics.
Yeah.
As religion becomes privatized, or even in some cases ceases to be an influence in people's lives, they often turn to politics as their way to express their religious zeal and passions, which don't go away, even if religion goes away.
That's right. We don't have heaven anymore, so we're going to make heaven on earth. We're going to the worker's paradise and all the rest. Whittaker Chambers firmly believed that communism was best understood in religious terms,
right,
not political terms.
And then in grad school, one of my teachers, George Lindbeck, published a book called The Nature of Doctrine, and that was published the year before I came to grad school. And I remember going to visit the director of graduate studies, who was then Hans Frey, very eminent in his own right. And I said, Mr. Frey, is there anything I should do to prepare for grad school? Because it was maybe in June, this time of year, and with things starting in September. He said, well, you have to go march right to the bookstore and buy Mr. Lindbeck's new book, The Nature of Doctrine, which I read dutifully that summer. And I got to say, I didn't understand a single word of that book because I kind of was approaching theology too much as a kind of spiritually energized philosophy. And I didn't really recognize that
doctrine.
Well, that theology is more like, it's more like jurisprudence, it's more like constitutional law than it is like philosophy. It's making sense out of the primary language of the faith, scripture, liturgy, and liturgy. It's trying to bring forward the inner logic of this primary language of faith, whereas philosophy is reasoning from first principles. And I remember my first year of grad school, we were doing a course with Karl Barth, kind of breaking my teeth trying to figure out kind of how Karl Barth's kind of Hegelian language really worked. And then the penny dropped, and I realized, no, he's commenting that the letters of St. Paul provide the logic. Hegel provides the concepts, not the logic. And once that really helped me understand that theology is an attempt to think in accord with the logic of Scripture, not something that's trying to sort of motor forward on its own steam.
Okay. In the last minute, if a theology PhD student was going to enter into a PhD program in 3 months, can you give us 5 book recommendations you would offer to that aspiring soul?
Well, I think I've taught in the past Robert Jensen's 2-volume Systematic Theology. It's short by theological standards. It's relatively short. It's genuinely systematic. It's deeply idiosyncratic. And so in that sense, I wouldn't call it authoritative in any sense, but it teaches you how to think systematically. And I think that's something that any young theologian should aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
I was very influenced by and would recommend Hans Urs von Balthasar's Mysterium Paschale, which is his commentary on Christ's crucifixion. And there's a volume that I remember first time I read it, it was like he goes through these scriptural perspectives on Christ's saving death. And it's like he triggers these biblical avalanches of biblical citations that kind of stream down the slopes. And it's a important book to liberate a young person from being overly limited by biblical scholarship. It's a way in which any theologian should be able to feel the freedom to use the Bible as the language of their own theology.
Hmm.
I think Newman's Oxford University sermons are the best entry point to the vexed question of the relation of faith and reason. And in those sermons, Newman makes, as usual, some very fine and helpful distinctions between different senses of reason and the sense in which they are compatible with faith. So those would be the ones that I think, those are only 3, not 5, but...
They're big.
And so I think that the young person should think systematic theology, biblical theology, and then with Newman, a kind of philosophy of religion.
Yeah.
And those are kind of the 3 angles that would be very useful.
Yeah.
Entering in.
Good. All right. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Mark.